we will call the meeting of the Climate and Energy Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and we're going to take a look at passing the minutes from the January 10th meeting. Representative Ream, have you had time to look at the minutes?
Yes, I have. I'll make a move to pass the minutes then.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Seeing none, minutes are approved. And we're going to move on to presentations today. We had some great presentations yesterday talking about IIJA and IRA and some of the opportunities that our state will be in line for. And we're going to kind of continue down that road a little bit today as well, hearing from some of the utilities in Minnesota as well as some of the businesses that work in clean energy. And so we're going to start with Xcel Energy and Karen Haas, who's the regulatory policy specialist. Welcome to the committee, and if you could please enter your name for the record and begin with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Akam and members. My name is Karen Haas. We're here representing Xcel Energy. I'm really pleased to be here today. I thank you for having me. I have just a couple of brief slides and remarks to highlight our work on the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which I'll try not to trip up on those acronyms. These really present very exciting new opportunities for Xcel Energy and our customers and communities in the state of Minnesota. So you'll see on slide two here just a brief comparison of the two laws, and I know you heard a lot about them yesterday, but in short, they're groundbreaking. They're new laws that will help speed many aspects of the clean energy transition here in Minnesota, and they're really great complements to Xcel Energy's goals and to the state's own climate and energy policy objectives. So as the presenters discussed yesterday, IIJA dramatically expands the U.S. Department of Energy's budget and creates many new programs to drive innovation and support clean energy. The IRA, on the other hand, is a great companion to IIJA. Notably, the IRA creates and expands tax credits for clean energy investment and energy production, and that directly reduces costs for our customers. So moving to slide three, I'll just touch on three areas that we're especially excited about at Xcel Energy. But first, I really want to emphasize that the wheels are really in motion here already. We have been leading the clean energy transition in Minnesota now for a long time, and we've been pursuing new technology and innovation for many years. With IIJA and IRA, we are able to move faster and further and do so more affordably for our customers. With that in mind, we are actively pursuing IIJA funding opportunities from DOE, and we're working really hard to bring projects to Minnesota for our customers and communities through those nationally competitive processes you heard a little bit about yesterday, while leveraging the IRA to keep costs low. And we aren't doing this alone, of course. We're working really closely with partners, including the state, to bring that investment home. So first on this list is hydrogen. We think hydrogen has a major role to play in deep decarbonization, both in electric generation and in natural gas distribution. So with multiple partner organizations, we're pursuing the Heartland Hydrogen Hub, which Mr. Kelly from the Department of Commerce touched on yesterday. We're working on that full competitive application process right now. That's due to DOE in April. And as that is moving along, we already have a hydrogen project underway with support from DOE that actually predates IIJA and IRA. Down at our Prairie Island nuclear plant near Red Wing, we already have begun a demonstration project to install a high-temperature electrolysis system, which will start to produce hydrogen next year. Now, and we also know that long-duration energy storage will be especially crucial in the years to come as we continue to deploy more wind and solar on our system. Technologies that can store multiple days worth of electricity are in development, and those are the types of carbon-free dispatchable resources that we need to ensure we can serve our customers reliably every day of the year. And we are currently preparing an application for IIJA energy storage program funding, which is due in March. One other note I'll make is that in 2019, the Minnesota legislature recognized the importance and potential of energy storage in legislation that allows public utilities like Xcel Energy to seek approval for energy storage system pilot projects. And our teams are actively working with those battery energy technology companies and other partners to develop such innovative pilots that we may propose to the Public Utilities Commission for approval, and which would benefit from IRA tax credits. So stay tuned on all of that. Turning to tax credits, ultimately what these tax credits in the IRA do is reduce costs for our customers because we pass those savings on directly. These tax credits will help drive innovation in areas like hydrogen and energy storage, as I mentioned, but they will also lower the cost of major projects that are already in progress, like Sherco Solar. Sherco Solar, as you may know, will be the largest single solar development in the upper Midwest, creating 900 union construction jobs, workforce development opportunities, and while supporting the Sherco coal plant host community in Becker, where our coal units will be closing before the end of the decade. So although the U.S. Treasury is still refining its guidance on tax credits, right now with the production tax credit and there's an additional bonus for the project being located in Becker, we estimate that the IRA will lead to customer savings upward of 30% on that project. And so keeping bills low, it's really high priority for Xcel Energy, and the IRA will enable us to do that. Help enable us to do that, I should say. So these tax credits not only drive innovation, but they also reward our customers for the things Xcel Energy already does really well, like generate carbon-free energy from our nuclear plants. So the IRA creates for the first time production tax credits for nuclear power, and that really recognizes nuclear's continuing value in the clean energy transition, so we're really excited about that. Lastly, I want to highlight briefly that a major requirement of IIJA programs is a community benefit plan. So DOE requires applicants to submit detailed plans for things like community engagement, labor, workforce development and recruiting, and environmental justice. We have a long history of serving Minnesota and partnering with our communities, employees, and stakeholders. So we have a really good story to share there with DOE. But as you heard yesterday, labor will be an incredibly crucial component to implementing all of this. So we look forward to continuing our collaboration with state agencies, our labor partners, this committee, to ensure the necessary growth and development of Minnesota's energy workforce. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, share some of this exciting opportunity. You know, we do plan to take full advantage of these laws for our customers and communities, but really both the IIJA and IRA are still in early stages of implementation. So we've hit the ground running already, though, and we look forward to sharing more and working with you on our progress in the future. That concludes my prepared remarks today. Happy to take questions.
Thank you. And yeah, we will take a couple minutes for questions before moving on to the next. And first, we have Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really good to have you here today. Thank you. And from a community member in Monticello, thank you for your longtime partnership with the city of Monticello and its residents and surrounding area. I have a couple questions. So I actually got to go out to Idaho Falls to DOE's laboratory there, and they told me there that Xcel was partnering with them.
Yep.
And so I was really excited to hear that that's in the hydrogen production. Wondering if you could just expand just a little bit as far as where that is, as far as, you know, is it planning? Are you, do you have shovels in the ground? Do you have up and, I mean, like, where are you at with that? And then the other question I have is, you had talked about Sherco converting to solar, and I can't remember how many megawatt hours of nameplate capacity that is, but if you could just mention that briefly, and then what is the end of life recycling plan for that?
Thank you, Chair Akam. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for those questions. I don't have the status of the hydrogen pilot at Prairie Island off the top of my head. Like I said, it's definitely going to be starting to produce hydrogen next year, but I can follow up with you on that information. Sherco Solar will be 460 megawatts, and I will follow up with you as well on the recycling plan for those. I know that's of interest to different communities and stakeholders.
Thank you. Real quickly. I was on another trip and ran into a legislator from Illinois, and they were talking about a new facility that they're building in Illinois that is sounding like first in the world, really, recycling, kind of commercial level recycling of solar panels, where you literally put the panel in and it comes out in all of its parts and extractions at the other end. They're under construction, I believe. I'm wondering if you know anything about the facility that's planned or in the process of being constructed in Illinois.
And Ms. Hazen, let's try to be brief in that, and we've got three others to ask questions, so if we can move along quickly, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
Sure, Chair Akam, Representative O'Neill. That's a short answer, is that no, I don't know about that project, but it sounds great, and I will see if I can find more information.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Huss, my question here is, you know, we've done a lot of presentations on these, on the money from the IIJA and the IRA. Is there any interest by Xcel in carbon sequestration or carbon capture technology? Are you partnering with anybody?
My apologies.
Chair Akam, Representative Igo, I am not aware of any plans or partnerships in the works, but that doesn't mean there aren't any, so I will follow up with the proper people and get you that information.
Follow-up, Representative Igo?
I'll just follow up and close. You know, there's a, you know, Minn Kota Power in North Dakota, is, you know, their Project Tundra is going to be taking coal-based power plants like the one at Sherco and turning it into a plant that's going to sequester at least 80% of the CO2, if not more. I just think it's an impressive technology that, you know, when there's an abundant resource like coal, that would allow to keep those facilities moving forward and allow that baseload power, because we haven't seen solar-tested baseload power yet. I represent a lot of the heaviest users in the state when it comes to baseload power, and I think it's something that we should definitely be looking into. So we'd love to have further conversations with you and Xcel Energy.
Next, we have Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Haas, excited to see you all diving into some of the benefits of the IRA on hydrogen and energy storage and tax credits. On tax credits, there is a side of it also that is for consumers as well as businesses and organizations, and on things like renewable energy as well as heat pumps. What are you doing to help your customers take advantage of those, and what's your view on that? Because that, you know, those are substantial tax credits, and we know they'll now be around for 10 years. So how are you going to prepare the network to handle that?
Sure.
Great. Excuse me. Great.
Thank you, Chair Akam, Representative Kraft. We are, so from an IRA tax credit perspective, we know that the state will be eligible for some IIJA money as well for new electrification programs, and so we'll be partnering with the state to make sure any overlaps with our existing customer programs are matched up there. And we are, from a grid readiness standpoint, we are very much incorporating these new laws into our forecasting and our planning. We've known for a long time that we need to be investing in our grid. It's just aging. It's getting to that point. So we're taking the opportunity now, while we're just upgrading things, to plan more for that greater electrification and higher loads.
Madam Chair, follow up, Ms. Haas. So on the side of heat pumps, for example, like, will you be having program? You considering programs to help customers transition from fossil gas to electricity?
Ms. Haas.
Thank you. I don't have the answer to that question, but I can follow up on it.
Okay,
Representative Mecklen, and then we're going to move on to the next testifier. If you can hold, we have three others in this part.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe you, Ms. Haas, I believe you mentioned tax credits, and particularly to the Becker solar project, that there was more money available now. Do you have the dollar amount of what, how much tax credits they're going to be getting on this project?
Thank you, Chair Akam, Representative Meckland. I do not have that, the dollar amount, but it is upwards of like 33% is our current estimates. I believe that information is trade secret, but I can follow up to confirm that.
Representative Meckland, did you have a follow-up?
Just a quick one. Thank you, Madam Chair. You also talked about storage, long-duration energy storage. Do you have a, can you give us a, like an idea of what is long duration? How long is it? How much energy is being stored? And
sure. Yes, thank you. So right now the standard commercially available battery technology is usually about 4 hours. And so we're looking at multiple days of energy storage.
And thank you so much for your testimony. And we're going to move on to our next testifier, David Rinaldo with Great River Energy. Please come down and please enter your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair Acom and members. my name is David Rinaldo. I'm the Director of Culture, Communications, Marketing, and Member Services for Great River Energy in Maple Grove, Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to participate and talk with you today. Great River Energy is a member-owned electric cooperative. We are a not-for-profit and governed by a democratically elected board of directors. Great River Energy is a generation and transmission cooperative, and we provide wholesale electric service to 27 member owners throughout two-thirds of the geography of Minnesota. First, I want to say that we look at the funding opportunities in the bipartisan infrastructure law, the IIJA, as a once-in-an-era investment opportunity. The last time this sort of investment was made was 1936 through the Rural Electrification Act. And I have to say, that's part of Electric Cooperative's origin story, so I would be remiss not to introduce that aspect to you all. Imagine a business model where people come before profits, and cooperatives went across the countryside to bring electricity and turn the lights on to rural Minnesota and America, farmsteads, and small towns. See, our members are at the heart of everything we do, and we want to make sure they're included in opportunities like this. And no doubt, Great River Energy is strong because our 27 member owners are strong. However, we recognize that we don't exist in a bubble, which is why we openly embrace opportunities to work with the state of Minnesota, other partners like utilities, environmental NGOs, labor, and clean energy businesses to really create innovation through collaboration. And I think you'll see that's the theme I'm talking about today and the lens at which we look through at these opportunities. Electric co-ops have been called labs of innovation, and that's a distinction we're very proud of. So what makes us different? Really, it's the co-op principles, the values that we look through as we make business decisions, and these can apply to any cooperative. Electric cooperatives, grocery cooperatives, dairy farms, even REI, where you can buy outdoor equipment. Today's electric cooperatives have developed incredible programs and systems to ensure that we provide reliable electricity that's affordable and in harmony with a sustainable environment. And those three things make up Great River Energy's triple bottom line. With this in mind, Great River Energy has spent more than a decade evolving our power supply portfolio proactively. We're transitioning from a historically coal-dependent utility to one that will soon be over 50% renewable because it makes business sense and because our members have asked us to do that. Great River Energy has 1,600 megawatts of competitive wind contracts going on now or in development, enough to power a million homes. And over the last decade, we have exited coal contracts early. We've retired two carbon-emitting generation resources and began co-firing our last unit with natural gas. By reducing our coal-based energy and more than doubling our renewable energy, we will reduce our carbon emissions by more than 80% by 2032. That's nearly two decades ahead of Minnesota state goal. Also, we're local in every sense, as well as our power supply. It includes member-sited energy resources, including solar and wind, as well as the nation's largest demand response program per peak load. That allows us to be incredibly flexible with our membership. It allows us through things like Wi-Fi enabled air conditioners, water heaters, and electric vehicle chargers to shift energy usage to the smart time of day or times that are more optimal for the grid. This is significant. In fact, 10% of the energy GRE provides to our members that flow through the system come through one of these special rate programs that allow the flexibility. These programs provide tens of millions of dollars in wholesale cost reduction to our members, along with grid resilience and flexibility, like I mentioned. We also have been a leader in electrifying the economy of Minnesota. We were the first utility in the country to offer renewable energy directly tied to electric vehicles at no additional cost for the lifetime of the vehicle. We also are seeing now nearly 100 EVs added to our system every month, which is up. We have many EV special programs and rates, along with our partners, Dakota Electric Association, our biggest member in Farmington, which I know some of you are members of, and Schmidty & Sons Transportation. We were able to bring and pilot the Midwest's first electric school bus right here in Lakeville. We're big fans of heat pumps, and that's why we're a founding member of the Minnesota Air Source Heat Pump Collaborative with CEE. And we also have sprinkled indoor agricultural pilot demonstration opportunities throughout the state of Minnesota, which have enabled fresh, local, clean produce in some areas where that's not always easy to access. Another smart use of electricity. All these reasons are why we want to do more and collaboratively. The IIJA and appropriated funding provides Great River Energy and our members, and really Minnesota, to really enable some blue sky thinking. The opportunities are abound, and we have our eyes wide open with partners. The efforts we're taking can be boiled down to three main categories. Those are grid resilience, smart grid, and grid innovation, as well as four additional that we've got our eyes on, which I'll briefly mention at the end here. The grid resilience was founded upon our historical investments, ensuring the grid in Minnesota is ready for whatever Mother Nature throws at it. And we've seen a doozy, right? Last week, the first year, week of the year, we had a top 20 snow event, and of course we all remember the 2021 stifling summer heat. Great River Energy's grid has continued to work as it was intended to. And the grid resilience opportunity builds on that success and helps us look at it in more of a systems approach so we can be ready for anything. The project aims to improve resilience and reliability by focusing on areas that are considered most vulnerable to extreme weather. Oftentimes, we have to prioritize based on population levels and sizes and locations. This funding would allow us to look at it as a system. Under Smart Grid, it's all about flexibility and optionality, the top thing consumers and our end-use members through our members want. We're partnering with the Beneficial Electrification League to author a consortium bid around grid edge technologies. These are technologies like the all-electric Ford Lightning that actually becomes a mobile generating unit that can move from local grid to local grid. We're collaborating and connecting and additionally partnering with 20 other cooperatives we were selected in the Midwest to be part of a bid that the National Rural Electric Association. So you can see the pattern here. We're collaborating and binding onto partnerships with hopes to have a leg up on the competition for this very competitive funding. Under grid innovation, we're very happy to partner with the state of Minnesota through the Department of Commerce on sponsoring a proposal for grid innovation, and this is specifically focused on innovations around technology. The state and utilities will have access to better data, so when it comes time to make decisions about policy and everything from transmission build-out to electric vehicles, we'll be well-informed. It's sort of an all-tech-on-deck approach as we look at the future. Now, I mentioned there's a few things on the horizon, and this will wrap up my comments. We're looking at the Grid Resilience State Formula Grants sometime mid-year. Commerce presented on this yesterday. This one requires matching state funds to achieve the approval. For equity, we do need legislative support so that outstate Minnesota, rural Minnesota, and the areas our members serve are included. The second is long-duration energy storage. Of course, we've got some experience here, partnering with Form Energy and our plans to install a 1.5 megawatt multi-day storage battery system capable of releasing over 100 hours when wind and solar have gaps. The third is energy improvement in rural and remote areas, the ERA program. This is designed specifically for communities under 10,000 inhabitants, which happens to me be the majority of what our members, the electric cooperatives, serve. And then finally, We have been engaged with the University of Minnesota to explore opportunities to use green ammonia as fuel for small generators, which could enhance the agricultural efficiency. So Great River Energy is very excited about this once-in-an-era investment opportunity. We're fully aware of the magnitude of the funding available, and no one will work harder to represent the interest of our member owners and the resilience, reliability, equity, and affordable access to the Minnesota grid. Thank you. That concludes my comments, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rinaldo. I appreciate that. And we've got a couple minutes for questions. Representative Igo, would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I was just looking up Great River Energy's grid while you were presenting there because I wanted to see your guys' makeup. So it looks like, you know, in 2020, 55% coal, and then we get to 2027 and projected. And I was reading, and it all looks incredible, but I was wondering what is Rainbow Purchase? And, you know, I think I know what it is, but I just want some clarification on that.
Yep.
Mr. Rinaldo?
Chair, Representative. The Rainbow Purchase is a hedge that we're using for reliability through through 2031. So later this year, we drop down to 350 megawatts of purchase through Rainbow, and that steps down through the year of 2031, where we will no longer purchase from Rainbow.
Can you please let the committee know what the Rainbow Purchase is, though?
Yeah, Rainbow Purchase is a coal plant in Underwood, North Dakota.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions by the committee for Mr. Rinaldo? Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, you know, you appreciate your time, Mr. Rinaldo. Just a question. You talked a lot about kind of how the rural cooperatives are democratically elected and the positives of that. How much autonomy do you think your members want? As far as, you know, what have you heard? I know you've got some larger cooperatives, but as far as state mandates and self-direction, you know, a lot of the things it seems like you're doing are kind of on your own. Kind of where does all that sit with your members and being locally elected officials in their regions and state mandates?
Mr. Rinaldo.
Chair, Representative, thank you for your question. The answer is that the democratic process of an electric cooperative seems to be working. We've been able to meet the environmental goals and the visions that our democratically elected boards have set out without mandates at this point. It allows us to be innovative and nimble to adopt projects like the battery electric school bus, the demonstration solar that we demonstrated throughout the state of Minnesota with our membership. And so it, of course, relies on the partnerships I mentioned early, but it seems to be working pretty well. Thank you.
Representative Olmos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm really excited that you're here, too. I've had the great opportunity to tour your headquarters a couple times in Maple Grove. And what's so interesting to me in this discussion is what you have all around your headquarters, which is all the different types of solar. So it's just interesting that you've got, like, I don't know how many varieties at this point, because with COVID, I don't think any of us were doing a whole lot of tours. But then it's connected inside, so you can see live what its capacity factor is and what it's actually producing at any given moment. And I remember the first time I went to Wright Hennepin, which is one of your people, and they were really excited to show me their solar field and their battery storage. And they were telling me the nameplate capacity, and all of a sudden a big cloud came over, and we were watching the meter just drop, and it went to one-third of the nameplate capacity. It just dropped like that when it was cloudy. I'm wondering, since you track all that and you really pay attention to capacity factors of, you know, how much energy are we really producing versus the nameplate, can you just let us know what you're finding there at your headquarters in Maple Grove?
Mr. Rinaldo.
Thank you, Chair. Representative O'Neill. I definitely can get you that information. It changes by the day and, of course, by location. So you're right. I mean, it totally depends on where the sun is and how it's projected onto the panels at the time. I'd be happy to share with you some historical data from our headquarters if I could email that to you today or tomorrow.
Yeah, that would be great. I know that in past when I've talked with folks from GRE, I think that she had said at that moment that the best that they had was about 11%, and I'm sure since then it's improved. But 11% capacity factor, you know, when you compare to like the nuclear power plant, which I know that's a ridiculously high bar of 95% of the time they're producing the full nameplate capacity. or even Sherco, which is pretty high. You know, it's 2,400 megawatts per hour of power, just turning it out 24/7. So I was just, it's just really important for this discussion to know, like, what can we expect out of a solar field in actual production? So anything you could provide for us would be super helpful. And I just know that you guys happen to have an amazing test facility that you monitor at every second throughout the day and keep the data. So, like, to me, you're like the data expert in this. So I appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Representative.
And thank you so much for your testimony. We're going to go on to our next testifier, if we may, Brian Burant with Kinexis Energy, Vice President for Supply and Business Development. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Brian Brand, Vice President, Power Supply, Business Development at Kinexis Energy, Minnesota's largest member-owned utility serving over 144,000 members. Representative Meckland, Representative Newton, thank you for your service to thousands of Kinexis members living in your districts. I appreciate the opportunity today to share some of the innovative experiences in greening the grid that we have. I realize time is tight, so my presentation will briefly touch on what Kinexis is doing with battery storage, solar, and the flexibility with a new power supply contract. Kinexis Energy has a service area of just under 1,000 square miles, and we are on that it overlaps with 12 Senate and 20 representative districts. 90% of our members are residential and account for 69% of our revenue. Two-thirds of our system is underground, and this percentage is increasing as we are proactively converting overhead lines to underground each year to improve grid resiliency. Regarding resiliency, for the last 5 years, Kinexis has provided service reliability in the top 5% of all utilities nationwide. We are into our fifth year of operating 15 megawatts of battery storage coupled with 10 megawatts of solar. We have been very successful using the battery storage system to time shift the delivery of solar to coincide with our monthly billing peaks for demand response. The knowledge gained from this demand response application is the foundation for our next battery project, which is for distribution plant deferral. Our next battery project will be at the Vadnais Heights substation. It's on the edge of our service area, which is mostly developed with low load growth. However, the substation is fully loaded. It is at a point where the traditional utility solution is to replace the transformer with a larger one to handle load spikes from air conditioning over the extreme hot summer days. We need to increase the capacity of the substation. So next year, in lieu of replacing the substation transformer, we will be adding a battery storage system to act as a shock absorber to strategically clip load spikes during the hottest days of the summer, the hottest hours. We plan to add a 2-megawatt, 8-megawatt-hour battery at the substation. When deployed, the system relief will be equivalent to taking 1,000 homes offline for 4 hours. The project is supported by economics showing that the battery storage was the least expensive solution to increase substation capacity. As you've likely heard, batteries are like a Swiss Army knife, having many different applications. This functionality will increasingly be part of the solution for the evolving grid. As a start, our solar projects are truly distributed energy resources located across our service area. They are interconnected to the distribution grid with all generation staying local. Nothing flows back onto the bulk transmission system. The sites are all planted in pollinator habitat as part of our vegetation management plan. We have learned a lot in regard to developing solar on less than optimal sites. Starting in the upper left corner and going clockwise, these pictures show our experience developing sites that are not square, not flat. We have built around areas deemed to be seasonal wetlands, thus the open pocket in the solar array pictured in the upper right. We have wrapped solar around an airport's runway protection zone, thus the L shape shown in the lower right. We have built on a site with soil conditions that were marginal for solar foundations, land that could not be used for housing. At the time these projects were built, they incorporated leading-edge technologies, The 2018 projects were coupled with battery storage and a demand response application. The 2020 project tracks the sun from sunrise to sunset and generates power on both sides of the panel, a benefit in the winter when the sun reflects off the snow. Kinexis participated in the state's 2020 feasibility study for solar development of state-managed closed landfills. Of the 110 landfills that were included in the study, the closed Anoka-Ramsey landfill, which happens to be across the street from our office, scored in the top five for solar development potential. Additionally, this landfill was included in the 2021 omnibus bill that transferred money from the general fund to MMB to prepay the general obligation bonds so that MPCA can execute agreements to facilitate the beneficial reuse of the site for solar installations. While the site meets the less than optimal classification, 4 to 6 megawatts of solar can cost effectively be built on the site. In terms of our future resources, we are actively working to secure land to be included in an RFP to add 10 megawatts in 2024. I've referenced the Anoka-Ramsey landfill in the previous slide. The bonds used for site improvements were paid off last November, and we are currently working with the MPCA to option the land so that we can include this site in our RFP. Our goal is that the Anoka-Ramsey landfill will be part of our 2024 solar project. And finally, a significant result effective January 1, just 10 days ago, Kinexis transitioned to a customer of Great River Energy and exited membership. What stakeholders can expect now is Kinexis continuing to innovate in greening the grid and sharing those practices with others. During 2023, with input from many and detailed analysis, we will be preparing a resource plan for our board's approval to serve members affordably, reliably, while engaging practically on achieving Minnesota's carbon policy. Regarding co-op success, we know GRE will continue to serve well the needs of the remaining members. In our sector of the electric industry, an exit from a G&T membership is notable and newsworthy. We sincerely appreciate GRE's broader view in negotiating our exit in a way that benefits GRE's members, Kinexis, and GRE itself. They stepped up as a leader, and many will benefit. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Got time for a few questions. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just your comments on, you know, less than ideal, developing some solar sites on less than ideal land. You know, that's been a big conversation kind of in rural Minnesota, the use of, you know, good prime farmland and, you know, access to it and, you know, better use and the rest. And you know, if you were to, you know, have a wand, you know, it's my feeling that, you know, if you have 5 feet or 2 feet of good solid black dirt, that's probably not the place to put solar. You know, is citing, you know, concerns and some of that legitimate? As far as flat and hilly and sandy versus, you know, black dirt, like kind of where does that all fit from your perspective and your study there?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, I take phone calls every month from farmers, typically those who are at the end of their career whose kids don't want to get into it. They're looking to create an annuity for their family, and when they offer up land, it's not their prime farmland. When I get out there, it's either low ground that's hard to farm, the soil conditions aren't the best, it's hilly. Those are the pieces of property that are being brought forward. Kinexis, we're in the North Metro. Housing's expanding. If there's any potential for that piece of ground to have housing developments, we can't afford it for solar land lease rents. So the parcels we're getting are less than optimal. We make it work. We have cost-effective interconnections with the distribution grid. We have net no new interconnection capability or expense. That's why these projects have been done on a cost-effective basis.
Representative Swazinski, anything else? Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could answer a few questions about this Brightfield site. It says that the total acre area is 267, and then it says there's 128 acres of buffer slash buildable area. How many acres of this particular location do you plan on covering specifically with solar panels?
Madam Chair, Representative Meckland, the 267 acres in total, we don't anticipate nor do we want to build on the cap of the landfill. You can't put a pile through the cap. We're looking at the buffer land on 120 that is the skirt land around. There's an oak savanna on the site. In the southeast corner of that quadrant of the parcel is about 40 acres. And that's what we're looking to do, some mild grading to put the panels out there to make it accessible for a single access tracking application.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to ask the same thing because I've been getting some emails about folks that want to put solar panels on top of landfills. That's a bad idea. I mean, obviously you can't put it where the hill is. You could only put it in the surrounding area. So that's what I was going to ask, the same thing. And forever, whoever's listening, just you can't build on top of the pile. Thank you.
Well, with that, I thank you for your testimony today, Mr. Barrett. Thank you. We're going to now transition to some members from the clean energy business community, and we're going to start with Greg Mast, who is the Executive Director of Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. Please come on down and please enter your name for the record and begin with your testimony. Y'all got here just in time. This worked out well.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Mast, and I serve as the Executive Director of Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to join you this afternoon to talk about the business case for clean energy here in Minnesota. For those committee members who may not be as familiar with SEEM, we are an industry-led, nonpartisan, not-for-profit organization representing the business voice of clean energy here in the state. We work to educate Minnesotans on the economic benefits of transitioning to a clean energy economy and are committed to delivering a 100% clean energy future that is good for business and Minnesota's citizens. Our business membership is comprised of over 50 energy efficiency and clean energy businesses who employ tens of thousands of Minnesotans all across the state. So in just a moment, you're going to hear directly from our company leaders who will share how their organizations are seizing the opportunities to drive business growth, spur job creation, expand investments, and deliver innovations across Minnesota as we transition to a net zero economy. During this legislative session, you'll be considering bills that are poised to further the tremendous momentum of energy efficiency and clean energy in the state. Our hope is that sharing business voices with all of you today will bolster your understanding of how investing in energy efficiency and clean energy is a bipartisan action. We want you to feel confident in championing or supporting legislation on clean energy and climate policies, knowing that it's good for business, it expands opportunities, while also delivering benefits across our entire energy system and economy as a whole. This includes power generation, transportation, buildings, and more. So as our organization often says, clean energy means business, and we look forward to working with all of you to ensure that Minnesota leads towards a prosperous and inclusive clean energy future. So with that, Madam Chair, I believe our business leaders are ready to begin their presentation as you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Mast. Appreciate you being here. And first up, I think we're going to hear from Betsy Engelking from National Grid Renewables. Welcome to committee. Please enter your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's great to be back in person at the Capitol Complex again. My name is Betsy Engelking. I am the Vice President of Policy and Strategy for National Grid Renewables. I have about 35 years in the energy industry in Minnesota, starting with a stint at the commission in 1988 through Great River Energy and Xcel Energy, and ending up here at National Grid Renewables in 2012. So National Grid Renewables is a It's a nationwide developer of wind and solar. We were acquired by the National Grid Companies in 2019. Before that, you probably knew us as Geronimo Energy. We have over 1,000 megawatts of wind and solar developed here in Minnesota, over 3,000 megawatts nationwide, and we're still working on a lot of good stuff. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the business case for wind and solar in Minnesota. It's kind of an old story for a lot of you because, you know, you were around when the renewable portfolio standards were passed, and it's a new story for some of you because, you know, there's still a lot of potential in Minnesota, and we're really excited about developing it. So talking about the business case, the first business case in Minnesota is jobs. Renewable energy, clean energy is a job. It's an engine for job growth. Right now, there are about 3.2 million Americans. Sorry, I was a motor mouth over in the Senate because they had to go fast and trying to slow myself down here, that are employed by clean energy. And if you want a comparison note, that's compared to 1.2 million Americans who are employed by the fossil fuel industry. Over the years 2020 to 2021, the industry added 300,000 new jobs. From 2015 to 2019, clean energy jobs grew 70% faster than other jobs, the nationwide growth rate. The median hourly wage of clean energy workers is 25% higher than the general workforce median. And also, wind turbine service technicians and photovoltaic installer jobs are the fastest growing professions expected for the next decade. So there's a lot to do with wind and solar. The second piece of this is the amount of economic activity that this industry brings to Minnesota. We have two of the preeminent nationwide wind construction firms here in this state, Mortenson and Blattner. And that is because we did so much so early on renewable energy, and they saw it as an opportunity to get into the business. 62% of Minnesota counties host clean energy projects. If you host a clean energy project, you get production tax revenues. And for many counties, this is a vast majority of their budgets in greater Minnesota. Minnesota counties received $16 million in production tax revenues in 2020. And that was about $14 million from wind and $2 million from solar, but solar is quickly becoming a larger percentage as more solar projects are being built. Landowners themselves received $23.6 million in land lease payments in 2020. That is money that helps stabilize farm income that is multiplied through economic activity in the community, and that helps power a lot of what is going on in greater Minnesota. In addition, during construction periods where the population of some of these smaller towns grow by 300 or 400 or 500 workers, there is a boon for restaurants, lodging, other businesses. And, you know, for example, we had a business on one of our first wind farms down near Laverne that a 100-year-old restaurant that was going to close down was able to make repairs on their building and stay open just as a result of Mortenson being down there for 3 months building our wind farm. This is a huge economic benefit for greater Minnesota. We now have something called the Inflation Reduction Act, which I know you heard a lot about yesterday, so I won't go into it in detail, but if you're interested in it in detail, please feel free to give me a call. This is designed to supercharge clean energy growth. With all the states that are looking for large percentages of energy from renewables and clean energy sources over the next, you know, 20 years or so, this is what was really designed to get us there. It includes a 10-year or more extension of the wind and solar tax credits. It also extends those credits to other things that haven't had them available before, like standalone storage, not storage associated with a solar or wind project, carbon-free and carbon-neutral energy production, and that also includes nuclear energy. there are new incentives put in place for green hydrogen, which a lot of people think is the green fuel, green storage mechanism of the future. There are a lot of incentives in this bill that are designed to assist jobs and labor in Minnesota. National Grid Renewables has built the large majority of their Minnesota projects with organized labor. This law now requires us to pay prevailing wages and to have a certain percentage of apprenticeships involved in all of our projects just to get the basic full tax credit. In addition, we have additional incentives to use domestic content in our projects, as well as there are incentives to construct more domestic manufacturing facilities. And these are going to be, I think, a big plus for our organizations that are reliant on sometimes foreign suppliers of our pipeline. So it's a really, really great story. But there's a down story, a downer. Right now, Minnesota cannot reap the benefits of this law because we don't have enough transmission. We do not have any clean energy at this point that can be interconnected and cost-effectively put through the grid until we get new transmission lines in Minnesota. We have had a great opportunity. We had a great history of doing this. CapEx 2020 was when all of the utilities, munis and co-ops included, got together and decided what were we going to need for reliability and to deliver the clean energy required by the 2007 Renewable Portfolio Standard by 2020. And they got together and they agreed on things and they built a number of lines that enabled a large amount of clean energy to join the system, and a lot of that was developed in Minnesota. MISO, Midcontinent Independent System Operator, does long-range transmission planning. They recently passed a very large long-range transmission plan and set aside a set of tranche one projects that are going to be the first ones to be permitted and built. And those projects are not necessarily favorable to Minnesota. They resolve some Minnesota concerns, but mostly they are designed to bring clean energy into Minnesota from North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa. That means we don't get the economic development. There is a line that we think is going to fall into Tranche 2 that will run across southern Minnesota that will definitely help connect a lot of the wind that there's potential for down there. But what we really need right now to supercharge this. Right now, we don't think that we're going to see new transmission in the state until 2028 or later. The tax credits run out in 2032. So while it doesn't seem, it seems like we have a long highway, it's really pretty short for us. And so, you know, we would really like to advocate for policies that would require utilities to take a look at this transmission, particularly if I hear the right rumors that a lot of renewable energy may come out of this session, to construct the transmission projects so we can get those projects in Minnesota. So with that, I thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to talk to you at any point about this.
Thank you, Ms. Engelken. We're going to hold questions until we get our group of business leaders through. So thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Nina Axelson with Red Catalyst. Please welcome to committee. Enter your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members, and Clean Energy Economy Minnesota for the opportunity to be here today to discuss clean energy business innovation and opportunity for Minnesota. My name is Nina Axelson. I am the president and founder of Grid Catalyst. We're a Minnesota-based energy accelerator. People seem to think that's something I'm building in my basement, but it's programming for startups, entrepreneurs, small business. So it is tech innovation, but it is also absolutely about growing business. We work across the state, public and private partners, including many established energy and clean tech businesses. Grid Catalyst was launched because we wanted to leverage the major increase in new technologies and business opportunities in the energy sector. As you hear about different technologies today, it's recognizing that there are thousands of other innovations, probably millions, that happen under the waterline that create new business opportunities and improve our grid, our efficiency, and the delivery of energy into our homes. I'm in here today to encourage our state partners to work with us to catapult Minnesota to a leadership position in the global clean tech and energy market. In order for that to happen, we need two things: collaboration and investment. I say them as if they're simple. I know that they are not. To illustrate the collaboration needs, I'm sharing this innovation ecosystem graphic. Minnesota has much of what you see on this graphic to be a global leader in this wave of opportunity. We have great higher education and research institutions, leading businesses with expertise in the sector, and we have clean tech companies working locally and globally, and we have a really talented workforce. So moving from the middle of the pack to the lead doesn't have to be a major lift, but it has to be done with a lot of intention. The regions that are attracting the most private capital and emerging businesses, they're a step ahead of us. And it's because they're connecting the activities. So when you look at that, you can say, oh, I know 3M's doing this, and Cummins is doing this, and the U is doing this, and it's all really great, but you need to have that intentional connective system that moves those ideas where they need to be successful. So we are missing that similar programming that can elevate Minnesota as a go-to energy and clean tech market, supporting and advancing businesses from idea to commercialization. A great example of this that many of us know about already is Medical Alley, which facilitates industry collaboration, innovation, investments into emerging technologies, and it's part of what has made Minnesota a global leader in med tech and health tech. So this leads us to the second challenge: increasing investment opportunities that bolster startups and strengthen the regional economy. Global clean tech venture capital funding topped $70 billion in 2022. That's up 89% from the previous year. With major investments in energy storage, renewables, and mobility, there are also clear market signals that you've already spoken about here today in the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS and Science Act. And those are spurring new manufacturing and deployment in this sector. This surge in private and federal investing creates a once-in-a-generation opportunity to position us for new business and emerging tech, including entrepreneurial and startup pathways, expanded technology research, deployment, development, investment, manufacturing, the whole gamut across the ecosystem. Over the next 10 years, we forecast upward of $200 million in available funding for innovation programming, but it's competitive. So if we want to draw that to Minnesota, again, we need that intentionality. The immediate challenge is that despite a volume of capital, innovators based in or wanting to work in Minnesota are not getting access to that. They are looking outside of the region for investment and support and to grow their businesses. This can lead energy and clean tech innovation to leave our state, fail to thrive, despite all the assets in the ecosystem already mentioned. So if we are ambitious and collaborative with public-private partnership, we can set the foundation to attract more capital to these startups. In most states where similar investment strategies are deployed, the metric that's used is follow-on funding. In Oregon, if they put in $6 million and they're bringing in $120 million in follow-on funding, that's great for that economy and is really helping with that burgeoning market. Failing to invest in this wave of opportunity also comes at a cost to Minnesota. We will miss out on new business growth and diversification. We will pay a premium to buy those products from other regions, and we will have to wait while those products get adapted to the Minnesota northern climate. So what do we need to do to lead? Grid Catalyst envisions a Minnesota Energy Alley with five key areas of impact and opportunity. These represent the development timeline for entrepreneurs. We need to be training and educating them more at the beginning part of the funnel, supporting them as they grow their businesses and become entrepreneurs and develop products, and helping them as they commercialize their technology. Throughout all these steps, we need to provide strategic financial mechanisms, including startup grants, seed funding, company formation assistance, the de-risking of private capital through finance and credit enhancement, and technical assistance, especially for under-resourced communities. We already know there are some other programs. Launch Minnesota is a great example at DEED. The state has just partnered with the University of Minnesota on the Minnesota Venture Capital Program that's working to support startups, but they are not exclusively working to bolster our clean energy innovation ecosystem, and that's really critical. At the heart of these actions are two key recommendations: collaboration and investment. The time is now to claim our fair share of a multi-trillion dollar opportunity in energy and clean tech. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Thank you, Ms. Axelson. Next, we have Satish Jayaram.
You got that right.
From Cummins please introduce yourself to the welcome and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Satish Jaram, and I'm the General Manager for the Power Systems Innovation Program Office at Cummins. I would like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my testimony. Cummins is a global power technology leader that designs, manufactures, distributes, and services a broad portfolio of power solutions. At Cummins, our mission is to make people's lives better by powering a more prosperous world. We understand this includes our role in creating a healthier planet, which starts with our products. For the past 100 years, our business has centered on innovation and improvements to diesel and natural gas engines for the heavy-duty on-highway and off-highway markets. This includes innovations to reduce the emissions from engines, as well as expanding our portfolio of solutions and products to achieve zero emissions. Destination Zero is our strategy to meet this goal by reducing greenhouse gas emissions and supporting the transition to decarbonized power. The plan has four components: lower tailpipe emissions in our products today, reduce overall well-to-wheel emissions, work with our customers to drive adoption of cleaner technologies, and work towards zero emissions by 2050. The journey to Destination Zero starts with a deep commitment from our entire business. This includes continuing to advance some of our combustion engine and component-based solutions that we have today and trying to get them close to zero as possible. At the same time, we are advancing zero-emission solutions like battery electric and hydrogen fuel cell technologies. Underpinning our technology and products in the field is our integrated sales and service network that supports our customers around the globe. To reach zero emissions by 2050, we believe it will take a combination of advanced internal combustion engines and the use of zero emission solutions such as battery electric and fuel cell electric. For internal combustion engines, they can be paired with low carbon fuels such as biodiesel, renewable natural gas, and even green hydrogen to reduce the well-to-wheel emissions. To reduce well-to-wheel emissions for zero emission products, they need to be powered by electricity from a decarbonized grid or fueled by hydrogen produced using renewable energy. Importantly, we must produce products that our customers demand. Our customers use products to run their businesses, so upfront cost and the total return on their investment are very key considerations. Unlike the passenger car market, the heavy duty market is incredibly diverse with challenging duty cycles and applications that are difficult to electrify. We must provide a variety of low-emission solutions and allow our customers to determine which is the right solution for their applications. By working collaboratively with stakeholders and partners such as yourselves, we believe we can reach zero emissions by 2050. I'm excited to share that we are investing in our Destination Zero strategy right here in Minnesota. Cummins employs almost 2,000 people in the state between our power generation business in Fridley, Minnesota, our power systems corporate offices in Shoreview, and our sales and service network in White Bear Lake and Duluth. In this slide, you will see our power generation manufacturing facility in Fridley, our largest in the world. In October, we announced that we will begin producing electrolyzers in a portion of this facility. An electrolyzer separates water into oxygen and hydrogen, and when operated using renewable energy, it provides a fuel which is carbon-free. This green hydrogen can be stored as compressed gas or as a liquid form that is highly energy dense and can provide clean power to decarbonize a variety of hard-to-abate industries such as heavy-duty transportation, power generation, and industrial processes. Choosing Fridley, Minnesota as our site for our first U.S. electrolyzer production plant highlights Cummins' long commitment to the greater Twin Cities area and an increasingly favorable climate for investment in Minnesota. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to share an overview of Cummins and our Destination Zero strategy. We can't reach zero emissions alone, and we need a collaborative relationship with stakeholders and partners such as yourselves. As the legislature begins its 2023 session, we look forward to serving as a resource to help the state achieve its climate goals. We encourage the state to support the transition to zero emissions by investing in battery charging, hydrogen refueling, and associated infrastructure necessary to decarbonize transportation, power generation, and heavy-duty transport.
I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're going to hold questions, and so we're taking a list here. Next, we have Mr. Jim Steffes with Zeus Electric. I apologize if I said that wrong. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to join you this afternoon. My name is Jim Steffes. You were close. And I am the Vice President of Strategy and Business Development with Zeus Electric Chassis, headquartered in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. We manufacture class 4 through 6 medium duty electric work trucks that are built on a frame that we call our power platform. It's a chassis that's modular and configurable, just so that it can meet the customer's application needs. Whether it's hauling salt to de-ice like we had today, or transporting our children to school with just a few adjustments to the frame, the same platform can be modified so that all of the applications that you can see in the circle of work trucks can be fit. All of these vehicles that we are manufacturing are zero emission. Transportation, as you probably all well know, is the largest source of greenhouse gases in Minnesota. And although trucks and buses make up only 3% of the vehicles that are on our roads, they actually produce 1/4 of all transportation emissions in Minnesota. The massive impact that these vehicles have on greenhouse gas emissions and other harmful pollutants make them the threat to both our air quality, our health, and the climate, and are obviously a major target for decarbonization. Replacing just one diesel bus with a Pegasus bus built on our cabin chassis will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by up to 54,000 pounds each year. But it also improves the air quality for our children who are riding inside those buses compared to the air quality that you would have in a diesel bus that can be up to 5 to 10 times worse inside the bus than actually outside of the bus. Thank you. Zeus is defining the industry standard for safety and performance, and our team has leveraged deep automotive and technology experience to launch an innovative product and business model in our pursuit to eliminate the most common challenges that fleets with medium-range vehicles face. This will enable innovation and efficiencies that go way beyond carbon impact. The trucks that we're building right now are Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard tested. They're FMVSS. The certification is done. And we're compliant up to 19,500 pounds. It's possible that you've seen myself or some of our other drivers driving around White Bear Lake or even downtown Minneapolis. But the ongoing testing and evaluation of our system engineering to ensure safety and performance will provide an innovative, thoughtful solution for the industry and our environment. There's a massive transformation in mass transit, and it presents many challenges. And among these challenges are effective policy making with strategic direction. Madam Chair and distinguished committee members, I ask you to consider and implement policy and regulation, policy that funds research and technology will provide Zeus and the state with a diverse, well-paid, well-trained, clean energy workforce. Additional policy is needed that provides grants and incentives for manufacturing to continue and expand with those that we've heard from with the Inflation Reduction Act. Funding will directly benefit Zeus. There's no doubt about that, but it will also positively impact our suppliers, our contract manufacturers, but most importantly, it will assist Minnesota public and private fleets who are working towards their own sustainability goals and are ready to adopt electrification now. Strategic deployment. Programs like the VW Settlement Grant are replacing diesel trucks on our roads right now. These programs need to continue and expand. Allowing vouchers and incentives will provide point-of-sale discounts to offset the initial acquisition cost for our Minnesota public and private fleets, who are also ready to transition to all electric. I promised Craig that I would be brief and want to thank you all for allowing me to testify, and I want to also thank you in advance for the hard work that you have ahead. And we'll wait for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
And next up, we have Ken Smith with Evergreen Energy. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Ken Smith. I'm the CEO of Evergreen Energy. We're based here in St. Paul. I was thinking about what Betsy's comments, that how long she's been in the business. Well, I've been in the business, I think, just a little bit longer. Just a farm kid, got an electrical engineering degree at North Dakota State and been working in energy my whole career. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share what Evergreen is doing in the clean energy space and some opportunities we have here in Minnesota. Evergreen Energy is a developer, owner, operator of campus and community energy systems. We work on healthcare campuses, higher education campuses, and communities could be a downtown, it could be a brownfield redevelopment, greenfield development, so forth. We're based here in St. Paul, and as a utility developer and manager, Evergreen is on the front lines of implementing real-world solutions to advance building systems and system efficiency and integrate renewables to serve the energy needs of those campuses and communities. Over the past 10 years, we have significantly expanded our footprint of operating advancing energy systems across the U.S., and we've also done quite a bit of work in Canada, and we have established a global reputation as a leading U.S. district energy developer, operator, and manager. Our work spans the life cycle, anywhere from planning what's possible, like we're doing with some campuses, how do they decarbonize the campuses, all the way through the design, permitting, financing, implementation, commissioning, operation, and customer service. Over the past 4 years, we've seen a significant increase in activity on campuses in particular, and a growing sense of urgency in communities, looking for how can they decarbonize, how can they meet their energy needs of their community. One community I was just with, they have several manufacturers, as a Minnesota community. They were hearing from those businesses, how are you going to meet your clean energy goals? We need to meet our clean energy goals, and we're dependent upon you to do that. Much of the work that we're presently engaged in involves project work involves some form of electrification using geoexchange, and by geoexchange it could be a traditional geothermal-based system, multi-well well field system, a distributed geothermal system, ATIS, which is aquifer thermal energy storage, and also the recovery and reuse of wasted thermal energy from industry, including wastewater treatment plants, which we're very excited about. We're currently engaged in implementation of multiple systems to achieve net zero carbon results for building, heating, cooling, and studying several others. One of the projects we're involved in is an Oberlin College. It's an over 100-year-old campus. Transitioned it from steam to hot water, integrated district cooling, and they will be all geothermal-based heating and cooling and effectively decarbonize the entire heating and cooling of that campus. We're in starting year three of construction soon of a four-year program. One of our hallmarks is we always start with efficiency, and then we look for ways to integrate in renewable energy and carbon-free energy sources, and we use a holistic approach to our work. By employing locally available resources, we're able to help our clients and customers reach their energy and environmental goals while also using proven technologies that are economically feasible, they're reliable, they're flexible, and we look to have resilience and adaptable integration of new technologies into the future. In the time I have remaining, I want to comment on the situation in Minnesota and some opportunities that I see that we have. Minnesota Department of Commerce reports that over 40% of the energy used in Minnesota is used in buildings. That's residential and commercial buildings. Together, if you add in industry, it's 70% of all the energy we use is industry and buildings. Commerce also reports that while utilities are meeting their energy savings goals, energy use and greenhouse gas emission goals are not being met. They're actually increasing. You go to the next diagram. It's estimated that Minnesota is currently wasting approximately 64% of the prime energy that we use. 64%. Most of that is heat. Some of that heat could be repurposed from buildings and industry and be used. As we heard today, and you'll be hearing on this session, the grid is changing a lot. It's decarbonizing. In many ways, as an engineer, it's breathtaking speed at which we're doing some of this work. But we're not meeting our goals to meet the overall system efficiency and our greenhouse gas emission reduction. If you Google the father of quality management, the first name that comes up is W. Edwards Deming, and he's quoted as saying, "The system is perfectly designed to get the results it is producing. The system is perfectly designed to get the results it is producing." You Google, and so Minnesota is taking action, but the system is not necessarily delivering the results that we want. Our greenhouse gas emissions are going up in the building sector, and the system efficiency, our prime energy use has been at about the same level, 1,800 trillion BTUs every year for, I think, since 2010, roughly. But the overall efficiency of the system, how much we're wasting, has been very steady. We have many opportunities to change the system. This is a list of some of them. One of the things we need to do is look at how do we close open loops. And what do I mean by that is where we have wasted energy streams, we need to be thinking about how do we use them. We should start with efficiency first. We have multiple instances across the state where we have a facility or a building, multiple buildings, and we are dumping heat there and across the street or even across the parking lot. We're consuming natural gas or some other fuels to heat the buildings next to them. Heat pumps are one of the things that we can use to capture that heat and lift it to a temperature that can be used. And we have many examples of projects we're working on doing that work. New multi-building developments in the metro area. There's a lot of talk about TCAP site, the Hillcrest site. Multi-building developments, these are clean sheets of paper. We should be thinking about how do we make them net zero developments. It is possible. It is being done elsewhere, not in Europe. It is being done in Europe, but it's being done right here in the United States. We're involved in a number of those projects. There's a growing list of examples where waste heat from data centers, wastewater treatment plants, and ag processing facilities are being recovered and used to heat buildings. You're going to hear a lot about hydrogen. You heard a little bit about that today. Electrolyzers, great technology. Put in clean energy, put in green energy, you get hydrogen, you get oxygen, and you get heat, a lot of it. It's about 40% of the energy going in, maybe a bit more, comes out as heat. We should be thinking about how do we hub these technologies together and use that energy. My last slide is an overview of how I see the energy system transitioning. And this is just informed by interacting with a lot of folks around the world and in the industry, but really on two parallel paths. One is renewable energy and the other is an efficiency. In renewable energy, we started adding renewable energy to the grid, and now increasingly we're talking about, well, how do we use that energy? How do we electrify more things? It's an active discussion right now in this state. On the efficiency side, we've started out with efficiency of things. Let's change out lights, let's do things like appliances and that kind of thing. And then we're moving to, well, boy, buildings are behind. What do we do about buildings? That's really where we are in Minnesota. We're talking about those two things. But if you look at where other countries are in particular, but even other parts of the country, they are moved to thinking about cross-sector coupling, and they're looking at how do they optimize the system. The two activities merge, and they're reusing energy to increase the energy security, to make the system more efficient, and leveraging the renewable energy that we have to reduce our energy usage, increase our security, and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And the ones that are really far in advance Well, they're applying circular economy principles. And that's where you wring as much economic value out of as you can out of the energy that's being used. When I visited Finland last year, this is where they're at. They're putting their money down, and they're going to work towards being fossil fuel free as a country by 2035. They're about the same population and land mass as Minnesota. That's what they're working towards. So it can be done. Minnesota has the same potential with its investments and actions and should transition more quickly to these approaches. Move from electrification to cross-sector coupling. Move from buildings and industry to the overall system optimization. And we will get more bang for the buck and more technology that Nina Axelson talked about. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Smith, and thank you to all of our presenters. We've got just a few minutes and a few questions, and so we'll start with Representative Swazinski, and maybe we'll try to be, if there are multiple questions for the same person.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. Betsy Ingokane? I'll just ask my question as you're walking up. You mentioned, appreciate your time, you mentioned in your comments talking about, I don't want to misquote you, but you said something along the lines of forcing the utilities to build out the transition lines. Could you kind of build that out a little bit for me to get my mind around, and what your expectation would be, and what would make you profitable?
The utilities largely plan through their ISOs, but there is nothing that prevents them from getting together and deciding to build transmission themselves. I think CapEx 2020 was a great example on how to do that. They got together. They agreed on the lines that they would need. They had forecasts of how much clean energy was going to need to be developed under the renewable portfolio standard, and they came up with a set of lines and were really the only state in the nation that built significant transmission between 2010 and 2020 because they did that planning starting back, you know, very early in the 2000s. And I think that a similar effort could be done. This was something that came together voluntarily in their case, but certainly it is something that could be required with oversight from the Public Utilities Commission. It is a get together and think about what you need to build kind of a law. And file something with the PUC and, you know, see what generates from there is the idea.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so kind of think about, okay, and then so like how would developers, so, you know, that's not really how things are work. You know, we have developers going out, you know, signing contracts with landowners, you know, power purchase potentials, essentially saying, hey, if we get lucky enough to get chosen by the PUC, you know, how do you feel that relationship would drive that, you know, as far as, hey, you know, Geronimo. You know what I'm saying. Geronimo. Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, so how do you feel a business like that would drive that policy?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, we operate under a federal law of open access transmission, which means that everybody who has projects that they want to interconnect to the transmission system has to apply to their RTO. It has to be studied to see how those would flow on the system and what would be the cost of the interconnection facilities and what would be the cost of the transmission upgrades in order to flow that power. And then the developers are responsible for that. There's no lack of developers that want to build projects in Minnesota, and there are a number of projects that are completely signed. There are some that are permitted, and they're just waiting for the transmission to catch up to them. So it's not a fundamental issue of it being, you know, profitable for us. It's the ability to, of course we work for profit, but it's the ability to build projects that really we've worked on for a number of years.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, wouldn't the argument be made that, you know, if it's your project, you should pay for the transmission?
Ms. Engelson.
Madam Chair, Representative
Rather than ratepayers?
We do. We do pay. We pay for those upgrades. And, you know, anything that needs to be done to the backbone system. And one of the reasons we're not building anything is when they study it now, you know, what needs to be done to the backbone system is a 100-mile, 345 kV line to somewhere that a developer just can't afford to put on a project. And so it is, there's a backbone transmission system, and MISO has recognize this with their multi-value project determination. There's a backbone system, and that is typically built by transmission owners. And then there is a upgrade system, and that's typically built by the developers who want to interconnect their projects.
Can you wrap this up?
Yeah, yes. Madam Chair, could I have the folks from...
Actually, we have another quick question.
Oh, sounds good. And then I want to have a question for the Cummings folks.
Okay, Representative Mecklen, briefly, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe National Grid Renewables is partnering with Xcel on the Becker site project, the Becker Solar. Am I correct on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, that's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a little quick follow-up here.
Yes.
So this last May, we had... three phenomenal hailstorms that came through that entire region and much of Minnesota. A tremendous amount of damage. I've been on several hundred roofs this summer, thank goodness. What happens to all these solar panels when they get damaged and they're leaking? And is there any conversation about putting something on the ground to protect the groundwater and the soils from when this stuff does happen? Because there was a significant amount of damage to all these structures. I mean, this was heavy-duty stuff. And we have some documentation of many of these solar panels being damaged. So is there something in place to protect our groundwater and our soils?
Ms. Engelking.
Madam Chair, Representative Meckland, I will agree that hailstorms could break solar panels. I will probably disagree with your thought that that's actually leaking metals. It takes a long time to break down those metals and actually leak them into the soil. But for what happens is as soon as those panels break, we actually have a stock of new panels on site. And we'll go out and replace those, and then we send the broken panels to a recycling facility. They recycle about 90% of what's in those panels. So there shouldn't ever be any metals leaching into the ground.
And we've got just a couple minutes left, so we're going to thank you so much for your answers. And Representative Susinski, did you have a question for Mr. Jarrett? Well,
are there other members that have questions? I don't want to...
Just
go ahead.
Okay, Representative O'Neill. And I'm not sure who your question was directed toward. We got just a couple minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The gentleman from Cummings, I think you were going to ask him something too. Okay.
Representative O'Neill.
Oh, you're right there. Okay, I'm so sorry. So you had talked about the hydrogen electrolyzing plant in Fridley coming online, but I didn't hear when it'll come online, or do you happen to know how quick that's going to be?
Yeah, so we will. We plan to cut the ribbon in March, April this year, and it'll go into production late 24, early 25. But we're going to ramp up to get to full capacity by end of 24, 25 is generally what we're working toward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what will you be, what's the full capacity? So what's the full breadth of that project?
So phase one is 500 megawatts of electrolyzers. The total capacity is about a gigawatt.
Thank you. And so is there any... is that just for store? So is this just a storage capacity? Because there's so many different uses of hydrogen, as you said. So is it just for storage, or is it more than that?
So the manufacturing of electrolyzers is the equipment that takes water and separates water into hydrogen and oxygen. So it's the manufacturing of that technology is what we will be doing in Fridley, Minnesota, not the storage of the then produced hydrogen.
Okay, got it. Thank you. I understand what he's doing. Thank you.
Well, thank you to all our presenters, both from the utilities as well as the business community for being here today. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.